This is WOWD LP Tacoma Park. Hello, and welcome to the Artist Experience Radio Show. I'm Sheila Blake, and I'm here with my husband and radio partner, Peter. We have on our Facebook page images of the work that we're talking about, and I think in this particular case, it would be particularly helpful for you to look at these images while we're talking about them.
Yes, and there's a link also to that Facebook page on our artisexperience.com page, so you can go there. That's art-as-experience.com.
Our granddaughter, Helen Magnolia, a.k.a. Maggie, is required to take another college art history course. She picked postmodernism because she expects to be excruciatingly bored, so what's the difference? I used to feel the same way, so I told her about our radio show and how we're trying to make art come alive and relevant. We're also dedicating this show to Maggie and to all of our listeners who might feel the same way about taking postmodernism at North Texas State University. So let's go.
Hello, Maggie. Our opening music was a sample of postmodern orchestral symphony music by John Adams for his opera Nixon in China. It definitely sounds different from Stravinsky and Shostakovich. It's tuneful and repetitive, but why is it postmodern? If you look up postmodernism in Wikipedia or the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, you'll be wading through a lot of academic language. Of course, much of it borrowed from the French, like bricolage or pastiche. It's our style here at the Artist Experience not to use academic language and to speak like normal people using common language. And the funny thing is, the artists themselves are speaking common language, right? It's the professors at the Modern Language Association conference and writers in the New York Review of Books who invented the term postmodernism.
Yeah. I'm allergic to academic language. When I hear bricolage or pastiche, I just want to run out of the room so I don't hit you, Peter, on the head.
Okay.
The best way I can introduce the topic of postmodernism is to try to explain what it's supposed to be and mostly why it matters. But before we get into that, art movements aren't linear. They just may seem that way because of the people who write about and name them with catchy phrases. It makes it easier for critics to pack artists together so they can write about ideas, ideas that are common to a group of artists and in some ways influence the artists, perhaps to fit better into their ideas. It's good marketing, too. Having said that, let's go ahead with the linear historical idea and at least start with the pre-postmodernism movement, or simply modernism. Modernism in art came about when artists freed themselves of the constraints of classical art, which represented the pinnacle of life and the life beyond in the heavens, transcending this world. The Early modernists wanted to free art from representing the actual or imagined visual world. They wanted to expand the foundations of what art could be, go directly to the source of what makes art pure expression, and to capture the essence of what's being expressed. They took the elements of what makes great painting and great sculpture, elements of color and design and line, and they found another way of expression that goes beyond the material world.
I like that. The pinnacle of life and beyond. It's true. The American abstract expressionists, Pollock, Rothko, and Newman, were not showing us pain. They were showing us paradise. Those soaring atmospheres of paint. Adam Gopnik said that one of the poles of American painting is the luminous oblong blur. That's a phrase he got from an evangelist in the 1920s who said, that's what God looks like.
He should know.
Yeah.
Well, artists in Europe became interested in psychoanalysis and the symbols that signify the realm of the unconscious. That was surrealism. They understood that this new kind of art that reaches into something that we can't see needs a new language. There were other movements, suprematism, which was started by Casimir Malevich by painting simply a black square. Suprematism is all about the supremacy of color and shape in painting. By sticking to simple geometric shapes and a limited range of colors, he could focus on the painting itself and not be distracted by representing a scene or a person or a landscape. You might think this is about as far as art can go, but that was just the beginning of pure abstraction. It was 1915. The world was in chaos. So this black square represented something hopeful, a symbol of the dawning of a new age with a spiritual significance.
Surrealism used academic painting to illustrate dream images from the unconscious. But another field was maybe more productive. Not the unconscious, but consciousness. Artists were fascinated by how our mind and perception can look into a field of marks and color and see space, light, the sea, meaning. Consciousness can do so much all on its own.
Okay, so let's get to it. What is postmodernism? Postmodern art, like any art, has many layers, but because critics are not artists and words are their medium, they use words and concepts that are counter to the absurdity and the entertaining value of postmodernism. And now I'm going to read you what I lifted out of Wikipedia.
Okay.
Okay, here we go. Postmodernism is an intellectual stance or mode of discourse defined by an attitude of skepticism toward what it considers as the grand narratives of modernism. Doubt regarding the efficacy of ideology and changing social systems, and opposition to epistemic certainty and the stability of meaning. Claims to objective fact are dismissed as naive realism. The postmodern outlook and its aesthetic influences are characterized by self-referentiality, epistemological relativism, moral relativism, pluralism, irony, irrelevance, and eclecticism. It regrets the universal validity of binary opposition, stable identity, hierarchy, and categorization. Postmodernism is sometimes considered the ideological and artistic reflection or anti-ideological ideology of the socioeconomic order of postmodernity. Now, you see what I'm talking about? I can't even get through it. So postmodernism brings together the ordinary and this extraordinary. It takes the sacred out of art. In some way, art has always been about freedom, and this is another way. Throw away taste, like Jess Kuhn's fabulous porcelain sculpture of Michael Jackson and his monkey Bubbles. Put an Elvis lamp in your living room. Take a selfie in front of Jackson Pollock's lavender mist and use it as a fashion background. Think about Pollock's tragic life while he's doing this painting and consider its trivialization that gets it to be used as a design for a necktie. And then, that's the beginning of our idea. The high and low crashing together is art. It's a reworking of the past, changing context, challenging our conventional expectations. Pop art, intermedia, installation art, conceptual art, and multimedia, particularly when video is involved, they're described as postmodern. But for a start, postmodern really begins in the early 20th century with the Dada movement and collage, because collage, which is using bits of various materials, especially painting, paper, cloth, wood, and glued onto a surface, you cut pictures from magazines to make new illogical relationships. We're going to get into this, but looking at the fantastic and questionable art, trying to get at what makes art, what used to be allowed, and how postmodernism threw convention out of the window. And here's the thing. This work is also gorgeous. Not gorgeous like Titian's Heavens or Monet's Water Lilies, but in an impersonal graphic way, a new knockout kind of beauty. Robert Rauschenberg erased the rules by combining a stuffed goat with a tire wrapped around him and standing it on a platform. This is art. Well, growing up in my family, my father listened only to classical music, and I've always been grateful for that because I do love it. But we never, ever listened to pop music in our house or car. Once my mother confided to me that she liked Eddie Fisher singing "Oh My Papa," we were silently being educated that there was a definite divide, the class of people we were supposed to be and the people who put ketchup on the table. It wasn't a lot of fun. I remember in 1964, I was in Woolworths in Durham, North Carolina with my little kids, and I heard this music, these chords and harmonies I've never heard, and I knew this must be the Beatles. My new friends in North Carolina were musicians. They were Appalachian string band musicians, and they scorned the Beatles. Loud, static, they said. And so I knew that I can end any conversation by saying, I like the Beatles. So I labeled myself as an outcast, and in my heart, I labeled them as snobs. For me, this was the beginning of my own postmodern embrace.
Okay, so the first trait or character of postmodernism that we have identified is a revolt against the rules that were still left in modernism, rules that defined what was high art and what was lowbrow and philistine. So in serious music, tunes were out, repetition was out. In painting, no representation, no nostalgia, no stories, only lofty, sublime things. Art was highbrow, and the priests of art told us what the Holy Spirit of art demanded.
You're listening to WOWD Tacoma Radio. This is the Artist Experience Radio Show. I'm Sheila Blake with Peter Blake, and we're talking about postmodernism, what it is. So a seeming new acceptance into the realm of art is graffiti. By its very nature, graffiti is subversive because it's applied to a surface where it technically doesn't belong. It used to be considered vandalism, and now it's considered art. There are walls in Pompeii with inscriptions that didn't belong there, but in the 1970s, unofficial, and that's with quotes, artists started using spray paint on trains, tunnels, on natural wonders, rocks, monuments, developed fiercely bold graphics, letters, a whole vocabulary. Years ago in Washington, there was Cool Disco Dan, and he spray painted Cool Disco Dan with quotes around it everywhere. There was no other message than Cool Disco Dan. And then he had been there. But what about Keith Haring? Why did people like him so much? Because he was fun. The best definition I found is that postmodernism means that everything is in quotes. And even while I'm saying this, my hands are sort of making air quotes around these phrases. And the whole thing with air quotes started with young people. It's an antithesis of appropriate, which is a word I hate. A sneaky, judgmental word pretending to be an arbiter of taste. Postmodernism released us from taste, the way that art movements lead the times. people are ready to accept fun as a goal. And because this has happened in my adult lifetime, the idea that art can be fun, I just embrace it. I think it's all around us, and most it's visible in architecture and design. The architects, Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown, who were married, wanted to go beyond the conventional boring templates for modern buildings. They loved Main Street, and instead of trying to change their surroundings, they designed buildings to fit into their neighborhoods, but they accentuate their usefulness and the ordinariness in a subtle and beautiful way.
I remember you decades ago, you showed me their book, and you said, hey, look at this.
Yeah,
and then we started seeing it like around in cities.
Yeah, it's great stuff. Well, look on our website, on our Facebook page, because you'll see pictures of their work. And these two, what they promoted was like the messy vitality of buildings and cities. Venturi first demonstrated what other things could be possible when he designed his mother's house in Philadelphia. Venturi's mom's retirement home included elements that reversed modernism's rules. For one thing, it was asymmetrical. The facade had mismatched windows. The gable of the roofline, which is typically positioned on the short side of the house, he put on the long side, which made it look distorted. Inside, it's a 5-bedroom house, and there were irregularly shaped spaces and rooms arranged like a city grid. The house contained whimsical elements, too, like a flight of stairs that led to a wall. The front and back of the house were also completely different from each other. To mess with rational elements, he added an arch that didn't frame the door. It didn't frame anything. It just is there. And he chose a pale green to paint the house because Bauhaus-trained designer Marcel Breuer said no one should ever paint a house green. So it was pure defiance. Venturi says that the oversized chimney was a middle finger to the establishment. Don't you love this?
Right. So you were going to talk about Dallas also because Maggie lives there.
Yes. I put Dallas in here.
Good.
And then there's Dallas, Texas, which is a monument to postmodern architecture rising out of the sand. The buildings, they rise as high as they feel like, and none of them look like they belong together. It looks like Texas had a city to build and money to build it, so they hired every famous living architect to design a monument to themselves. Each one is competing for attention and deliberately ignoring the other buildings around it. It's hilarious, that downtown. And Durham, North Carolina, where we lived for years, is a mess of architectural mistakes and bravado. The old renovated tobacco warehouse was a great start. And then they added a 1960s skyscraper. The neo-Gothic architecture of Duke and the Duke Chapel and glass boxes in blue and brown from the 70s, each one is screaming for importance. The buildings that survived the old downtown department stores are just sad, and they made attempts at places to sit and eat, but everything is homely and kind of desolate, and a lot of it is just plain mistakes. No one building has any relationship to any other, and each one is like a sort of a cartoon of architecture and puts all its features in air quotes. I don't know if this is postmodernism, or just a complete lack of planning, which I suspect it is. Postmodernism is a paradox. It's a contradiction in terms.
Right, that was a paradox. You're saying that postmodernism is kind of cheeky and irreverent, whereas modernism could be described as kind of a religion. It was a new religion, totally in sync with modern science, inspired sometimes by the advancement of technology, but also in bohemian opposition to the world of money. Since the spirit of art was a kind of withdrawal from the world, an ascetic devotion to higher things. Modernism was high, but it looked beneath the surface of appearances for fundamental truths about how beauty and meaning are created by the mind. This was definitely new, and really, in a way, it's still new. The history of art kept going on, but the task of modernism remains. I think both of us still have an enormous attachment to the great modernist painters and poets.
Well, I certainly do. Modernism is modest. Postmodernism is not modest. It's showy. It's billboard size, often. But I love to stop into the Phillips collection, and right there on the first floor is Marston Hartley, A Seascape, Rough Seas at Night. It's an easel-sized painting that asks you many questions. Postmodern paintings are big.
Right, and so the seascape at night, the sea represents death, you know, and sea, death, night, and the mother all together in one thing. This is modernism, all calling to us, come back, calling to your children, come back.
And then right after that, in the next room, is the de Kooning, his painting right. Asheville, which is really a pretty small painting that he worked on for an entire summer at Black Mountain College in Asheville. And it never fails to surprise me, that painting. It's like, I can't even tell you what it's about.
No, you can't. Every time I look at it, I see something new, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So modernism was most definitely sincere. It insisted on being authentic, like, be authentic. And it became highbrow, high class, the religion of the universities and the libraries, the BBC and NBC, even the CIA. By the 1960s, it was time to escape. So postmodernism is the opposite, is irony, and it's filled with irony.
Yep, well, postmodernism is not sincere. It's hip. It knows the score.
Postmodernism does not look deep into the fundamental nature of consciousness. It looks at the world of signs and symbols that flow over us constantly in advertising, product design, movies, television, fashion, music, magazines, 6 o'clock news, crime drama, celebrities. This is the world we really live in most of the time, most of the day, most of the week.
Well, I want to talk about one of the best and most memorable art shows I've seen ever. And it's the work of the De La Torre brothers. Their medium is glass blowing, which was invented in Babylon between 27 BC and 14 AD. So this is an ancient material, glass blowing. And that's part of sort of what they're saying. Mm. It's part of the joke. Mm-hmm. The De La Torre brothers, Einar and Hamesh, grew up in Guadalajara, Mexico, and came to Los Angeles. So they have their feet in both places, and their work is clever. It's hilarious, using the ancient techniques of glass blowing to make the tears of Jesus. Yet their parallel appreciation of both cultures and their personal experiences lead them to create art that's free of labels and feeds their desire to preserve the possibility of doing something new with something ancient and everything else in between. So I just describe, he uses a succession of truck camper tops. The one on the bottom is the biggest one, and there are maybe five of them, and they're successively smaller, and they really echo a Mayan temple.
Only yeah, so it's like a metaphor.
It is. Yeah. This is something I love. And they use glass and cast resin and popular arts and video and dollar store treasures. And it defies any kind of designation and gives us a new category of art that it really could be called border Baroque. And they do love shag carpeting. They do love glass-blown chili peppers. All I can say is just wait until you see this incredible work. The De La Torre brothers are funny and courageous. They mix up everything with their binational experience and influences, and then they spit it out. And I want to say that the Smithsonian is opening a new part of a museum that's going to be the Hispanic wing.
Oh, no.
And the De La Torre brothers, which I have not seen in Washington, are going to be there. So look out for them.
I saw an exhibit of the De La Torre brothers at the San Jose Art Museum. There was a moon lander, you know, like the NASA moon lander on the surface of the moon, but the body of the lander at the center of the legs was an Olmec head. And there were beer cans littered around the landing.
That's probably my favorite thing. And there were tires that were cut, sliced in half, like you would slice in half a donut, and they were placed around it, and they mimic the surface of the moon.
You mean like pits, or what would you, craters?
Yes, like the craters of the moon. Very good. The one thing postmodernism does is raise the question of taste. I keep saying this, but now in our present, many people see their bodies as blank canvases and have tattooed all kinds of pictures, religious Baroque symbols to children's books, Disney, flower gardens, mandalas, and tattoo artists are artists, and people seek them out as artists. So maybe the embracing the ideas of postmodernism might cause the tattooed to consider the juxtaposition of the images. You can have fun with it, not just looking for an empty spot on your skin that doesn't even work in my garden. I mean, think about what you're putting together. It could add a lot.
You know, the funny thing is that as soon as I make some big statement, I want to take it back. I mean, whatever we say, we mean it, but it's not 100% true. We've been, it's a stab at understanding. We've been really hammering away at this rebelliousness as a characteristic of postmodernism, but that's not the whole story. We'll tell a little bit more of it later. Because rebellion's always been with us in minor streams off to the side. You know, artists who were saying a century ago, cut the crap, don't make me laugh. I mean, what was Dada? It was disgust at the holiness of art and literature. All those people of noble sentiment who cheered the onset of World War I.
Yeah, well, Dada wasn't fun, though.
Right, no. It wasn't fun. It wasn't funny either. It was sort of like jokes without laughter. I don't know, maybe some people thought it was funny.
Well, think about Andy Warhol. He was such a breath of fresh air when he said, he being interviewed, could you ask that question again and could you answer it for me?
He was funny. Sometimes he would try to complete an interview using only the answers yes and no. He hired an actor to pretend to be him at book signings. He didn't actually write any of his books. He did all these outrageous things, and it just made him more popular.
Well, once when I was at the Chicago Art Institute, I saw someone who looked exactly like Andy. White hair, red-rimmed glasses, slight build, signing his books. But I never really knew if it was him. So I always want to say, I might have seen Andy Warhol. So the idea of art as entertainment, as fun, that's good, because what's wrong with entertainment? But when the new negates the past, maybe that's not so good, because we could lose our capacity to look deeper. So this is the Artist Experience Radio Show on WOWD Tacoma Radio. Today we're talking about postmodernism, and we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Welcome back. This is Artist Experience. I'm Sheila Blake with my husband Peter Blake. You are listening to the Artist Experience radio program here on WOWD Tacoma Radio 94.3 FM. We're talking about the loosely titled art movement of postmodernism, our attempt to define what it is and why it matters.
So I'd like to take a short, deep, vivid plunge into one iconic work of postmodernism, a work you might be familiar with, but even after all these years, maybe you're not sure you get the point. Andy Warhol's Brillo boxes. I think we can pull from them an important thought about postmodernism. So first, let's review. This scene is described in Louis Menand's wonderful new book, The Free World, which I recommend highly to all our listeners. 1962, the first pop art exhibitions had just taken place with lots of coverage, mostly scornful. Lichtenstein had just had a show with the prince of gallery owners, Leo Castelli. And Castelli, a genius of publicity, convinced another dealer to take a chance with Warhol, who had had tremendous success in commercial art, but had not yet cracked the fine art market. Visitors to Warhol's show saw 400 boxes on the floor, painted to look exactly like cartons delivered to a supermarket, cartons of Heinz ketchup, Kellogg's cornflake, and Brillo soap pads. You could buy one for $200. These were not ready-mades like Duchamp used to do. They were wooden boxes made by a cabinet maker, painted, then silk-screened on five sides, not six, with an exact replication of the logo art and lettering of the genuine cartons. Okay, thank you, Louis Menand, for that little history. It's my task now to describe an experience, because this is the Artist Experience radio show. An experience you could have had if you had handed over $200 and taken one home. Why would you do that? Imagine that you, lucky you, had a spacious loft apartment with hardwood floors. You place the Brillo box in the middle of that space. It's not a carton. It's a work of art that looks exactly like a real carton. It is not ravishing. It does not illuminate some beauty that heretofore had escaped everyone's vision. You can't look at it for a long time the way you look at a Cézanne. Nothing will happen if you do. But the room is transformed. The space around the box is transformed. Your friends will stop, amazed. There will be a conversation about it. I'll pause here for a digression. The value of art as a conversation piece is enormous, something you should all be aware of as you consider decorating your homes. Okay, but the Brillo box is on the floor. How is it art and not a joke? The first step, and the most important, indeed profound, is that when we look at a visual work of art or read a poem, we clear a space in our mind for the art to expand. You have to do this. If you read a poem the same way you read Poe's, at that speed, it runs by. It doesn't make much sense. It wasn't clear. You feel bad. If you walk by a Cézanne with a glance, even if you take a selfie, you didn't make that space in your experience. So to have an art experience, you have to clear that space within you bit by bit. And bit by bit, the artwork fills the expanded space. It turns out you can do this with the Brillo box there on the floor. It's a work of art, and the only difference between it and a carton is that you, the viewer, clear a space for one of them within yourself and not for the other. And it's the clearing of the space that constitutes the act of the art on the part of the viewer. Now, then, what comes in when you clear that space? Theory of art. This is conceptual art. Warhol is not as inarticulate and naive as his public act would have you believe. Warhol turned the dials of the current avant-garde one more notch, up to 11. So at that point, modernism had pretended that it had gotten rid of representation and commercialism, but it hadn't. Lichtenstein, by painting comic book scenes, was telling us that he had dropped out of the high serene place to the commonplace, but his art was visually gorgeous. The Brillo box, on the other hand, was indistinguishable from the supermarket carton. What makes the box art is the act of the viewer. Art can be anything it wanted. So the distinction between illusion and reality had not been erased, it had been pointed up and broken. So here we finally come to the kernel of what we might call the university theory of postmodernism. It is accepting and understanding that illusion is naturally part of art, and you expose it and undercut it. You can do that. You cannot erase it. All you can do is expose it. You can write manifestos saying, no more illusion, but you can't get rid of it. It's everywhere in everything you read or watch or think. Illusion, metaphors, the switching of places, of things, of meaning. It can't be erased, but it can be brought to the front. And the term that would later be adopted for bringing illusion to the front is postmodernism.
Wow, thank you, Peter. Very, very thoughtful. Wow. So, and there's something else, too. Art has always been about illusion, and that the hand of the artist created the illusion. I noticed when you were describing Warhol's Brillo boxes, his hand never touched those boxes. Right. They were given to a cabinet maker to make, mm-hmm. and silk screened mm-hmm. onto the surface. So that's something that we always do expect. That the fact that the hand of the artist created that illusion, that's a big part of the magic. Even when geometric abstraction, the finest, cleanest lines still have the artist's hand. But now that's left out. In fact, the final product can all be made in factories. Lichtenstein developed a way of printing his dots mechanically. Jeff Koons's work is done by other people in a factory, or maybe even more than one factory.
Yeah, and Andy's workshop is called The Factory. Mm-hmm. The cult of the hand of the artist has been trashed, but art remains.
Yeah, these are bitter pills to swallow.
Yes, particularly for you.
Particularly for me, but I'm used to it. In the time we have left, let's go over some of the most common characteristics of art that is thought of as postmodern. Let's start with Roy Lichtenstein. If you go to our Facebook website, you'll see some examples of Lichtenstein's work. He burst on the scene with his paintings that looked exactly like comic book illustrations. I mean, he would lift them from the comic books and copy them onto boards or canvas. And you might know how comic books used Bende dots, which is a printing technique, to get the shading and the colors.
You know, I always used to think that Bende was a French word, you know, Bende with an accent. But I looked it up yesterday and found that they were named after a person named Bende.
Lichtenstein emphasized that the Bende dots, he enlarged the dots to make optical effects. At the recent exhibit of Juan Gris in the Baltimore Museum of Art, we saw that Gris did that earlier. He used those dots as design elements, but partly as shading or transitioning one color to another. And Lichtenstein surely was standing on Juan Gris' shoulders, finding ever new optical effects.
So Lichtenstein appropriated comic book illustrations. He took actual illustrations, changed them slightly, emphasized the Bende dots, and enlarged the whole picture. So in addition to breaking the high-low distinction in art, he broke several other rules against representation, rules against copying or imitation. And so this is now called appropriation.
Well, I've talked about Lichtenstein before because he built his vocabulary of comic book techniques and he began to use them to explore the history of art. Lichtenstein went through a whole cubist period in the 1970s, even using sand as George Brock did for texture when he was exploring cubism. Thank you. So this is the 70s. Cubism was old in 1930, so he reprised the cubist still lifes of lemons, glasses, musical instruments, checkerboards, and pipes, and using only black, white, red, yellow, and blue, and occasionally he used green. He produced still lifes and landscapes and dramatic scenes and interiors which are handsome, witty, and unsubtle statements of the history of art. Juan Gris set it up for Lichtenstein. I think there's no way Lichtenstein hadn't seen Juan Gris use those dots.
So, again, this is appropriation. Or can I now use a French word? I wouldn't, except I don't know an English equivalent. And that word is pastiche, very useful. Pastiche is an imitation of style, like a parody. We're familiar with parody, but parody is sarcastic, usually. It's making fun of the style that it's imitating. Pastiche is like parody, but with the crucial exception, it's done in admiration of the style. So, of course, Lichtenstein loved cubist art. Brock, Picasso, and Gris. He lifted objects out of Matisse in a style that made his love of Matisse obvious, but he made something new.
Well, if you look at Matisse, Matisse had a catalog in his paintings, kind of like a Sears catalog, but it was a Matisse catalog, of actual objects that he surrounded himself with. They're plants and models and fabric and sunlight and shadows and floors and ceilings and many, many patterns that he incorporated into his compositions, which were his studio, his surroundings, and his invented harem situations with women and veils and hookahs from his trip to Morocco. So he used real objects to invent fantasy situations that he and his models dreamed up. There's a show at MoMA right now of Matisse's The Red Studio, and it's the one large, fabulous red studio painting along with the actual objects he painted in the studio. Lichtenstein pictured those same objects, the same ones, but they were in his comic book style compositions.
But you could recognize not just the object, but the echo of Matisse.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. The lemons, the goldfish mm-hmm. bowl, that funny triangular table with a plant on top. Mm-hmm. And then from there, he moved right through art history. He moved through art movements to Asian art, using his dots to become the atmosphere of Chinese scrolls and landscapes, and always with a detached, often humorous take, but always with attention to compositions and to the cleverness of inventing a new vocabulary to look back through time. You're listening to WOWD Tacoma Radio. This is the Artist Experience Radio Show. I'm Sheila Blake with Peter Blake, and we're talking about postmodernism, what it is.
So Philip Guston also, in another way, used the comic strip.
Well, Philip Guston invented a style of cartoon realism. It's kind of gross. It's cigarette butts and like everything you weren't allowed to paint. So it is, in a sense, a very postmodernist idea. Cans of paintbrushes, you know, these Band-Aids and lying
color.
In bed.
I mean, that pink. I mean, it's just the most ugliest color. And yet, you know, it's fascinating.
It is.
Right? That's
it
the
is.
Whole point.
Well, his whole palette was cadmium red and white.
Yeah.
It's black. Yeah. That's it. Or maybe sometimes brown, but it's mostly always that pink that's made from cadmium red and white. Ugh. And so he injected this kind of wry humor into the history of art.
With irony, so much irony in Guston. So what about James Rosenquist?
Well, James Rosenquist was an American artist. He was born in North Dakota. His parents were pilots, and his mother was also a painter, so she encouraged him in his art. And in junior high, Rosenquist won a scholarship to study at the Minneapolis School of Art, and then at the University of Minnesota. He moved to New York, and he studied at the Art Students League, and he made his living as a sign painter, which is after my own heart.
Right. I don't think our listeners know that story, Sheila. So Sheila was a sign painter with her own company when I was in graduate school.
Yes, I supported us through grad school. And the greatest thing about it was that my grandfather and my great-grandfather were sign painters, and I could tell when I started to do it. I was always good at lettering, and I could tell when I held that brush that it was coming through me, and thank goodness, that was great.
Right. One day, remember, we went to Manhattan and in the lower part of Manhattan near Broadway, and we went to this sign painting supply shop, mm-hmm. and the guy said, what did he say?
Because my mother was with us, and mother said, my father used to buy brushes from you. And he said, hi, I'm Shapiro. And he said, Shapiro, I used to sell to Shapiro, and I sold to his father. Right. My mother was so happy.
Yeah. Except he said, I sold Shapiro.
Right.
Anyway, it was that was fun.
Yes, it was.
And then he knew what the accounts were. He said, Pepsi Cola, right?
Yeah. X-Lax.
Yep.
Yeah. Vanita Hernitz.
So back to Rosenquist.
Yeah, well, Rosenquist said he painted billboards over every candy store in Brooklyn, and he got so he could paint a Shenley whiskey bottle in his sleep. In 2003, the art critic Peter Sheldahl asked Rosenquist about whether his application of sign painting techniques was sort of a cheap trick that he applied these techniques to fine art. I'm sort of disappointed that Sheldahl would have asked him that. I don't think he would ask him that now. So, you know, Warhol's photo silk screening and Lichtenstein's lifting of panels from comic strips, the goal in all cases was to fuse painting aesthetics with the signs and symbols of media-drenched contemporary reality. I love Rosenquist paintings. They're huge billboard-sized panels combining a jet plane with canned spaghetti and a doll under a hairdryer. And then, like, there'll be a landscape, too. Painted like a sign painter, deadpan. Everything is as important as everything else. I once got to have breakfast with him, a really nice guy. He was considered a pop artist, but what's the difference? He didn't meet Andy Warhol until they were each established themselves as individuals, and he hardly knew Roy Lichtenstein. When he was a sign painter, he was working high up over Times Square painting Elizabeth Taylor. He developed his style honestly and pushed it to see what it would say back. For any artist, no matter how much planning goes into his or her work of art, you can never know what the final result will say back to you. It's sort of like writing. You never know really what you're going to say till you write it.
Yeah, so Rosenquist didn't decide to be postmodern. He just was. Mm-hmm. And the art world accepted his innovations. So we might be better off viewing the term postmodernism as describing the world that accepts these artists rather than trying to stuff the artists into a category. It could even be that most of these, you know, artists that are called postmodernists reject the term. Nobody puts Andy in the corner. So, music, architecture, philosophy, they all changed in the 60s. And later, writers whose job it was to theorize about life and art, about society and how it changes, asked the question, what changed? Finding that things had changed, they gave it a name, postmodernism. So Postmodernism as a concept comes from philosophers, at the universities, and writers. And you know, there's nothing new under the sun, and whatever you say about postmodernism, somebody will be able to find an artist from the 1920s who was doing just what you're talking about. Maybe Gertrude Stein was there first. So let's not expect clear, pure definitions or clear, distinct categories. It's always going to be mixed up, so we got to be flexible. But being flexible is the mark of postmodernism. There are no essences. So you can't expect a definition of postmodernism to divide art cleanly into categories. Is this postmodernism? If an artist in 1920 was doing the same thing, maybe we got to change the definition. No. Logical contradictions are just embedded in the whole thinking.
So, yeah. How is this concept of postmodernism affected our everyday lives? Well, a lot. Fashion, for one. We love to combine combat boots with socks and a little sexy flowered shirt and a jeans jacket. I mean, what is that? And especially for men, shiny yellow shoes with a blue puffer vest and red frame sunglasses. Shirts never tucked in with pink metallic sneakers, leopard skin pants with a leather shoulder bag, or better, a patterned briefcase. Men have postmodernism to thank for the outrageousness of fashion and making it fun. Well, when I was in high school, that's when it first came up that there were so many rules that you couldn't do, like you could never mix a pattern with a plaid. You had to have matching sweaters, a cardigan over another sweater, and they had to be completely matched. You would never put red with pink. You would never put purple with red. There were so many rules about dressing, and the thing that you might do is make a mistake, and that would really just brand you forever.
Right, I remember boys and girls, this is before we had backpacks, but boys and girls had to carry their books different ways. Boys had one way to carry the books, and girls had another. And you didn't make a mistake.
Right, and now guys get patterned shoulder bags that sling over their shoulder, and they're very, kind of like gorgeous. Right.
But there's another thing. Kurt Varnadeau, in his lectures at the National Gallery of Art, the conceptual artists like Donald Judd, very plain boxes, how they freed up artists so tremendously so that the next generation, now let's just take like an artist like Richard Serra, we don't even think about, is he modern or postmodern? I mean, it's just... nothing is against the rules anymore.
Right.
And there's such a freedom, but it isn't just getting rid of the rules. It was also opening up the space of the exhibit space. There was something changed about the space in the room where these objects were and how the space opened up, and then new people, the new sculptors just rushed in and created amazing things.
Yeah. That sculptor that is now so suddenly bursting on the scene.
Charles Ray?
Yeah. Charles Ray. Oh, my God. He doesn't work in one style. He works in doing whatever he feels like doing in any kind of materials, and doing these kind of like a chrome casting of himself as a cowboy or just completely abstract balancing things of shapes. And all of these things are shown together because they have some things that are alike. And it's up to you to kind of figure out what the connection of these things is.
Well, for those of our listeners who are in the D.C. area, the Glenstone has a room, a single room, that has several Charles Ray sculptures in it. That room is electric.
Mm-hmm. It is. I think about it all the time. Yeah.
We'll close out our show with Jimmy Page and Robert Plant. Let's remember the original Stairway to Heaven in Jacob's dream. As recounted in Genesis, Jacob was traveling, and when night came on him along the road in the country, he placed a stone as his pillow under his head and dreamed of a great ladder that went from the earth up into heaven, with people climbing up the ladder to heaven, and, or maybe angels climbing up the ladder to heaven and other angels climbing down. God appeared to him and said, "I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying." So Jacob builds the first temple in the very spot where the ladder touched the earth. And the first stone of the temple was the one he had used as his pillow. This is the first image in our culture of access to higher ground and higher planes. When we think of modernism, we can see the modernists modeling themselves as the ascending angels. They were determined to leave this shabby world and to find the sources of truth and beauty. The postmodernists are like the angels descending to live in our grubby world and speak our grubby language. But they have a memory of the heights above. They have a memory of lofty beauty. And they are angels, after all, inspired maybe by demons, descending, but not fallen.
Peter, you're something. That was really good. And Maggie, if you're listening, we hope this was helpful, but not too painful. And maybe it was even a little fun, because we tried.
We tried. Okay, stay tuned to WOWD Tacoma Radio 94.3 FM or streaming at tacomaradio.org. Stay tuned to Bobby Hill and Clay Fink for This Music every Saturday from 10 until 1 p.m. This is avant-garde, improvised, postmodern jazz right here. Listen every other Sunday from 8 to 10 for our friend Gail Barron's Night Ride Home. She has a this is a show about singer-songwriters. It's really quite a wonderful show. Experience art and the visual in everything you do. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
All it glitters is gold, and she's buying a stairway to heaven. When she gets there, she knows if the stores are all closed, with a word she can get what she came for. She's fine.